industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or you would be.
A time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well, now you've got it.
Right. You tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio.
Yeah. The key thing is, don't be inhaling, don't be ingesting.
Stay inside, don't drink or eat anything.
These are important questions.
I understand that. Highest moment the last 8 years.
Highest moment the last 8 years. Well, I think the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome to the live version of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, broadcasting from the Studio, the rooftop studio here in Saidia, Morocco, bringing on guests from all over the world who have something outside the box to say, something uncommonly truthful to say, in most cases, about what's really going on in this benighted world. We have a great show coming up. In the second hour, journalist Rick Sterling makes what I do believe is his first appearance on Truth Jihad Radio. They'll be talking about his most recent two articles. One of them is on how it looks like the American intelligence apparatus manufactured the Olympic doping case against Kamila Valieva. So it's about weaponization of sports. And he also has an article out about how Israel benefited from the JFK assassination. He has read Laurent Guyonneau's book, JFK 9/11, and says it should be an interesting conversation in the second hour. First hour, Glenn Stanish is known to those of us who were following the 9/11 truth movement, and in particular, the discussion of what really happened with those airplanes, the allegedly hijacked airplanes of 9/11. He is the author of Uncle Sam's Christian Patriots. And I recently touched bases with Glenn around the question that one of my listeners raised. Whatever happened to Christopher Bolin, the author of Solving 9/11, one of the best books on the issue? Well, thankfully, it turns out that Chris is okay. He's just kind of laying low, having said what he's got to say, I guess. And so we'll talk maybe a little bit more about that as well. So let's get it going with Glenn Stanish. How are you doing, Glenn?
Pretty good, Kevin. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Good. Yeah, I don't know what I did to deserve this honor, but I hope I don't disappoint.
Well, I think you spoke truthfully about a red pill issue at some risk to your own reputation, perhaps even safety, although I think we're probably all just taking, you know, very slight risks in terms of, you know, our life expectancy might decline like 0.1 year, 0.01 year when we talk about these things. But I do appreciate your courage, because it's not everybody who is willing to put their name out there on, you know, truthful statements about 9/11. So maybe where we could start, I guess, would be the usual place of how did you get interested in 9/11? How did you wake up to the fact that the official story was a bunch of nonsense?
Well, back in 2001, I had been subscribing to American Free Press. And a few years before that, I was flying for TWA, and an old TWA captain introduced me to the spotlight. Anyway, it eventually reemerged as American Free Press. And, I liked quite a few of their contributors, but especially Christopher Bolin. I really liked his articles, and you know, thought that he was bold and courageous and truthful, and I just liked his writing style. But anyway, shortly after the event, when some articles first started coming out about alternative theories, I thought, oh man, I think you guys are going a little bit too far this time, you know, and I thought, I'm going to look for whatever, closer other evidence, whatever, that would maybe disprove some of the theories that were going on. And the more I looked, the more I thought, man, oh man, you know, I can't believe it. But anyway, one article in particular that Chris Boleyn wrote about was the crash site at Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and how, you know, the mayor and all these witnesses who were there immediately, within 15 feet of the smoking crater, said that they never found any evidence of, you know, a Boeing 757. So I started thinking about, you know, we had had to, part of our training, we've always, as new hires and recurrent training, is a course called Crew Resource Management. And that you it's a study of airline accidents and incidents. And, you know, you always look at, the well-documented scenes, and you also, look at like cockpit voice recordings and air traffic control recordings and flight data recordings and the scenes, you know, of the accidents. And I thought, how can there not be any wreckage? That, you know, there's indestructible, you know, engine cores and landing gear and tail sections and normally a debris field, even during high speed, you know, high descent rate contacts with terrain. So anyway, I thought I'd give American Free Press a call. I think I spoke with Chris Petherick, and he put me in touch with Chris Boleyn, and we got to talking about these things. And, you know, that's what started me on, you know, looking into it and definitely suspecting that something else was going on.
Very interesting. Well, of course, Christopher Boleyn is best known for his work on the demolitions of the World Trade Center and the very suspicious people and groups involved, presumably, in those demolitions, and maybe not so much really on the aviation aspect, which is almost more mysterious today. If you go to consensus911, I believe it's .org, you can find what the sort of scholarly segment of the 9/11 truth community thinks has been established as a consensus among, you know, all of us who are basically, you know, taking a truthful approach to this. And there's a pretty strong consensus about the demolitions of the buildings. Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth has done a pretty good job on that.
Right.
And as far as there's still a little bit of discussion about the modes of demolition and such. But as far as the airplanes, how did they create the illusion that 19 young Arabs supposedly hijacked these planes and in three cases hit their targets rather miraculously, and then in one case supposedly went into the ground in Shanksville? And clearly that's not what happened. There's not even any evidence that any of those 19 guys were on any of the planes, except for one obviously fabricated video of Dulles Airport. So the question is, how did they create that impression of the plane, you know, hijacked planes into buildings? And there's a lot of debate and discussion about that. And I'm still pretty agnostic about that, to the frustration of my friends who have much stronger opinions. How do you think we should go about investigating that? And have you arrived at any conclusions?
Well, I recently read, it was the Stephen Jones and Neil Harris paper study that, you know, found both evidence of both pre-activated and post-activated evidence of nanothermite and the dust and the smoke, you know, of the towers, and that also sulfidation took place on some of the few remaining pieces that indicated that, you know, nanothermite with sulfur added would, you know, was probably responsible for bringing down the towers. And so I do subscribe 100% that those buildings were demolished. And so then you get into the logic, you know, so that to me, that was like the big lie or whatever. And that it seems like you can't build a big lie out of any truthful components. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the classic example of that is that had they just sat back and allowed a bunch of, you know, Muslim hijackers, certainly ones that were as incompetent seemingly as these 19 guys, to just see if they can succeed in taking over planes and hitting buildings, that would have been a one in a million shot. And if they're planning to demolish those buildings, obviously they're not going to do that. They're going to have to take some kind of proactive measures to make sure that there's the appearance of hijacked planes hitting buildings.
Exactly. You know, I thinking about it, I've kind of come to the conclusion that I really don't think that either American Airlines or United Airlines lost an airframe that day, at least not in the way that, you know, has been proposed. You know, I've seen some other, I do think what was probably used were probably military surplus stock 767s, you know, the airlines have, 767s. So does the military, the Air Force. There are surplus 767s out there available for purchase. You know, and I think they were probably outfitted with the latest UAV guidance navigation systems, targeting systems, and I think they the two airplanes that hit the two towers were both drones of some sort. They've had unmanned aerial vehicle drone technology for years, decades, for just things like target practice, airborne target practice, of course, they, at the time they had, the Reaper and the Global Hawk, so that technology existed. It's just a matter of installing the avionics, but anyway, just the great lie, is that the towers came down due to burning Jet A. When we, that's been proven, that Jet A doesn't burn hot enough to even melt, or soften steel.
Yeah. Of course, the government.
You have to look further into the components, and it's just you can't create a great lie out of truthful components.
Right. Although they seem to have gone a little further in the grotesquely, outrageously untruthful components than one might expect. There are certainly there are some operations that stay closer to the truth, so they don't have to worry about so much. But this one, it seems like they didn't stick very close to the truth about anything. Like every major aspect of the official story is demonstrably false. You know, from the radical Muslim hijackers. Well, no, they weren't radical Muslims and they weren't hijackers. Hijacked planes. No, nobody hijacked any planes. Flew them into the towers. No, they didn't fly them into the towers. Maybe they were drones. And then the towers just fell down from office fires. No, they didn't. They were blown up. The whole thing is a lie at every level.
It's amazing. It's unbelievable. A story like that can have any credibility. I understand, it was a pretty traumatic event, some people may not be ready to look at things, critically a little closer after, a traumatized population of Americans. But after a while, you're like, okay, it's time to look at this, And I just don't see how anybody who's considered it can still subscribe to the official story. It's,
How about the commercial airline community And sort of two questions about that. One is, to what extent is there a kind of subterranean current of people who understand there's a problem with this official story? I certainly encountered a fair number of such people. I used to always make sure that I mentioned this, you know, things like pilots for 9/11 truth and such when I rode commercial aircraft. And I got everything from blank, uncomprehending stares to thumbs ups and, yeah, you don't know how right you are, kind of things from various people. So I kind of wonder what percentage of the, you know, aviation community gets this. And then secondly, maybe more importantly, you know, how would we figure out, like, if indeed United and American didn't lose any airframes that day, some sort of deception must have been employed to subterfuge that. And they, you know, they had, and then there was the scheduling of these alleged flights, which we think were actually scheduled. It's certainly strange that all the number of passengers on these flights was ridiculously low. I think there were a total of like, what, the low 200s, I think, for all four flights, cross-country flights, which is what, 50 or 60 each.
Right. Right. Yeah. You know, to answer your first question, I do think more and more, you know, airline folks are beginning to, you know, agree that this was a false flag operation. I do remember, you know, when I first became aware of it, you know, when I started talking to pilots, and I got a documentary from Dave Von Kleist that was 9/11 in plain sight, you know, and so I started sharing it with some of my pilot friends, you know, and as we sit there and watch it together, they just kind of, oh my God, shaking their heads, you know.
Shaking their heads in disbelief,
oh my God, I can't believe it, you know. I mean, not like really in disbelief, you know, kind of like the process of being enlightened is starting to take place, you know. Mm-hmm. And anyway, then I'd talk to guys, and I, you know, when my book was first published in 06, I handed out a few copies and would get some comments. I did have some guys get a hold of me and say, hey, you know, thanks for writing the book, and you know, that they felt like they should join Pilots for 9/11 Truth, but for whatever reason had reservations. I don't know. As far as the airlines do have the ability to like add extra sections to be for tickets to be sold. You know, I don't know the mechanics of it, but they could list an extra section to say from Boston to San Francisco. And once they got, you know, sold a few tickets or had a few names that they needed, you know, I say, oh, that's it, you know. But it does seem like it was a play out of the page book of the old Operation Northwoods, you know, where they had some people, and these airplanes diverted, and they were all loaded under carefully prepared aliases and things like that. That's kind of the situation that I think that went on, you know.
Yeah, I think that's as good a hypothesis as any. I have a couple of friends who subscribe to the sort of no planes hypothesis, who argue that this all sounds too elaborate. That is, that the, you know, setting up drones with, you know, first setting up commercial airline flights that end up, you know, you limit the tickets or whatever, and then you have to figure out some way to, you know, to dispose of those passengers, assuming there are any actual passengers who bought any of those actual tickets. Your planes presumably have to take off, because there's got to be, if there's no record of the planes taking off, that would create a problem. So you'd have to make your United and American planes take off. Then they would have to go somewhere, and any non-complicit passengers would have to be disposed of, presumably after landing. And you'd have to cross paths with your drones, like in Operation Northwoods, as it was envisaged in Northwoods.
Right.
And all of that is fairly elaborate. So I have one friend in particular who's really adamant, saying that that's all so difficult. Why wouldn't you just say there were planes when there weren't any? Just set off the bomb in the building and make sure the media reports planes and puts out fake plane videos, and everybody will in New York is going to think that they remembered seeing planes. Well, I agree with my friend that's not the case. I've been to New York. I've talked to a lot of people in New York, and it's very widely owned. Everybody in New York who could have heard these screaming low altitude, you know, jets coming in at 600 miles an hour at sea level, which
right.
is ear splitting noise and all of that, followed by the ear splitting noise of the crash. Everybody heard that. So, and then, you know, my friend then says, well, what if they, you know, broadcast that over a big loudspeaker or something? To me, that it's I kind of understand his point, that it seems kind of elaborate to do a Northwoods style plane swap. On the other hand, I'm convinced that the evidence that I've seen suggests that that's a lot more likely than the notion that they could have somehow fooled everybody into having all of these witness accounts of the noises in particular, and also a lot of videos as well as eyewitness accounts of the plane crashes, or the second plane, rather.
Yeah. Well, even the... you know, the first plane, there was one video that with the Nade brothers or whatever. You know,
and that's pretty suspicious.
Well, I've read some of that too. I don't know. You know, I guess these guys that are involved in these types of operations, you know, they brainstorm and try to cover most of the things, but. You know, most of the people that are around that camera look like they're looking up also to watch an aircraft, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I know there are some witnesses that we're talking about, you know, the second airplane being a big gray plane, that it wasn't. And you know, what American Airlines, what an airliner, and
pods and flashes.
That can be, you know. I mean, these witnesses that got a few seconds of airtime. Who knows if they were planned? You know what I mean? It's hard to say. But as far as going to the trouble of, you know. Oh, filling three buildings with explosives, and to have the drones. I do think they used another drone with a missile at you know, the Pentagon also. I don't know. I guess you come to some conclusions and realize it was all just hokum. And as far as all the minutiae, the fine details, it's you get to a point where it's like, I've looked at it as far as I can. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't dissect it anymore.
Right. Yeah. Once you've figured out that the official story isn't true, that there were obviously no hijackings by humans, and that at that point, you know, you really obviously need an investigation and prosecutions to figure out precisely how they did it. And it's interesting though that we haven't really made as much progress on understanding that aviation hoax element of 9/11 as we have in understanding the controlled demolitions.
I agree. You know, I did one thing out that I did want to mention. I talked to Chris Boleyn, and I was thinking about, and I'd never heard of anybody doing a Freedom of Information Act request for like tower logs for either, you know, Boston, Cleveland, Dulles, you know, the airports where, of course, it was Flight 93 that was reported early by a WCPO in Cincinnati. You know, the Flight 93 actually landed in Cleveland. And so anyway, I was thinking, has anybody done that? And I tried to reach out to Chris on an email to inquire about that, and I didn't hear anything back. And this was just maybe 3 weeks ago or so. I thought, what the heck? There's a Freedom of Information form that you can fill on the FAA, you know, website, and so I filled it in, just requesting the landing records for September 11th from Cleveland Hopkins. And first got a response, and I was buried in like 9/11 data, you know. And I got back with the lady at the FAA that manages the FOIA request. I said, look, you sent me a mountain of data, and I really just need a molehill. I said, I'm just specifically asking for, you know, the tower logs from Cleveland and landing clearances only. And so then this went back and forth for a couple of weeks. I got an email that it was taking a while, that they had to reach out to other facilities. So I'm assuming that they're trying to request logs from Cleveland or whatever, you know. And anyway, I write back when I hadn't heard anything and said, hey, how's it going? And we're waiting on data. Well, then I get an email that all these records now have been forwarded to the National Archives. That in order to get any of those records, you have to go to the National Archives. So then I'm thinking, well, we were both involved in this process for a while. I was thinking, if I would have requested, say, the tower logs from Mobile, Alabama, or Jacksonville, Florida, or you know what I mean, mm-hmm. that maybe they would have been forthcoming. It seemed like she was in the process of actually trying to get the data, you know. And then all of a sudden it's like, nope, it's all at the National Archives. So then I wrote back and I said, well, basically what I just told you, if I had requested Mobile, Alabama for 9/11, it seems like that would have been forthcoming. And then I got some kind of, well, this is not a forum for discussing, you know, 9/11 theories and things like that. But it you know, and I think I'd like to, when I get time, just follow up. She did give me contact information at the National Archives, and, you know, maybe some of those records could be forthcoming. There was some talk at, out of Dulles and Flight 77, you know, American Flight 77 didn't actually operate that day. And so, again, it's, you know, you can only kind of cover so much and try to dissect so much, and I haven't followed up on that. But it'd be worth getting, you know, the tower logs from Boston, Cleveland, and Dulles, just to see if these aircraft, you know, actually did take off.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Well, it sounds like there may be a cover-up in place there with that National Archives story, which recalls the New York Times report. When was that? I think it was pretty early on after 9/11 that the Times reported this extraordinary event where the FAA guys, a group of FAA people who had been trying to understand what was going on 9/11 as they followed these allegedly hijacked planes and were confused by inserts into their radars and so on from these drills that were going on at the same time. And so they're asking, you know, is this real or is this a drill? No, it's real. So they debriefed themselves. They had a tape recorder. And so at the end of that day, they sat down and did a big debriefing and recorded it on tape. And the New York Times then reported that their supervisor came and confiscated the tape and smashed it and cut the physical tape into little tiny pieces and deposited it in many different wastebaskets.
I think that sounds familiar.
And the New York Times didn't raise any questions about why such a bizarre thing would have been done. It was, you know, it's one of those, so many of these mainstream stories that are so damning, if you actually bother to read them and think about them. Like the one about the deepest mystery of 9/11 is the vaporized steel from these twisted remains of the beams and columns of, I think it was Building 7, but I think the same thing happened with the towers as well, that there were beams that were radically twisted into these sort of pretzel shapes and turned into a sort of a Swiss cheese texture, indicating that not only had the steel been melted, but actually vaporized. Now, I forget, I don't have my physics textbook at hand, but the vaporization temperature of steel is very, very high, orders of magnitude beyond what could be produced by ordinary hydrocarbon fires of any kind. So New York Times reported on that as the deepest mystery. What could have turned these giant columns and beams into pretzels riddled with Swiss cheese holes where their steel had been vaporized? It's a mystery.
And they leave it there.
Yeah.
No follow-up.
Right.
And then even when there are credible people, scientists that do peer-reviewed papers that do address those issues, rather than publish those, they just ignore them.
Right. So the fix is obviously in. And one of the questions is, what kind of fix? And maybe we shouldn't assume that everybody in on the cover-up was also in on the operation. The operation would have been need to know. And then after it's done, a whole lot of people would probably join the cover-up just to cover their butts and also to sort of protect the institutions that they're part of from the extreme embarrassment of the truth getting out. So Christopher Bolin's book, Solving 9/11, points the finger at Israel and its American agents. And I think he's probably barking up the right tree there. And that leads to the question of how can a supposedly a tiny little country of 15 million people over many thousands of miles away from the United States pull off something like this against the United States? Is there any, if Russia tried to blow up American skyscrapers and attack the Pentagon, would they get away with it? If China tried to, if some other country the size of Israel, like Togo or Benin or Mozambique. No, I think Mozambique is a lot bigger than Israel. But if some tiny little country tried to attack the United States like this, would they get away with it? So, why does this one tiny little country get away with it?
The times we're in is just kind of alarming. It does seem like our country has been subjugated by a foreign interest, the very powerful lobbies, very much involved in who gets elected and who they aren't marching to the right beat, seem not to get reelected. There's a relationship there that goes back to, I don't know, how far, at least 1948, before that, probably, but it seems like our political system, we're not represented. American citizens aren't really represented to the vigor that they should be. We've been kind of put, we have second dibs or whatever behind this little country and their concerns.
I agree completely. Yeah, it does seem that partisans of Israel dominate the media. Have a heavy presence in the financial system, are grossly overrepresented in campaign contributions or bribes to politicians, and in many other areas as well. Still, it's kind of mind-boggling to think that such a small country could have that much influence on the United States. And in this case, in order to pull off the kind of operation that we're positing for 9/11, they would have to have a lot of control over the airlines, the airports, the military response and certainly the initial government response.
The security of the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And on and on.
Yeah. The notion of a deep state, which is essentially a kind of a, it's as if organized crime ran the government or it infiltrated the government to such a point that an organized crime mob had final say on certain matters. I think that's one way of looking at it. You know, Peter Dale Scott came up with the idea of the deep state as the overworld that's as far above the ordinary society and government as the criminal underworld is supposedly below it. And I think that's part of the answer. And it's interesting, the notion of deep state, as it's become popularized, has become kind of mystified and it's been obscured a little bit, I think, in popular understanding. Like Trump talks about the deep state, but he's also totally a slave to Israel, which really is the deep state in terms of the crime cabal that pulls right. off these crimes. And
right.
And now the New York Times has just ran a piece pushing back against Trump, saying that the deep state is actually kind of awesome. And they are showing us these, you know, people doing space, you know, space exploration here and people protecting our agriculture there. And, you know, these kind of ordinary government bureaucrats and ordinary government bureaucracies doing productive things. And they're claiming that that's what Trump says is the deep state. And that's what Trump is. He's going to fire the deep state. He's going to fire all of these productive bureaucrats. But it's interesting that so few people understand what Whitney Webb makes so clear in her work, which is that the state of Israel has become really the center of the organized crime ring that is hijacking the American government. It's terrorized everybody to the point that nobody will stand up against them.
Yeah, it. You know, I've been looking at this is getting kind of philosophical, but you know, so many people think we're in rapidly approaching, you know, end times, World War III, things along those lines, and so I've started looking at the Book of Revelation, and you know, it. I just you're familiar with the book, I'm sure, correct?
Oh yes, I think I've read it more than once, possibly in Gidgen's Bibles in hotel rooms at least once.
Yeah, well, I think it's in chapter 17, chapter 18, towards the end, but it talks about there's like three, what I consider three main entities, you know, and it talks about this mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And then it talks about, a seven-headed beast, you know, and, then another two-horned beast that exercises all the power of the first beast before him. You know, so I'm thinking, all right, these three entities seem to be closely interrelated, you know, and thinking if you could determine the identities. So, the, you know, the book is written with a lot of symbolism, you know. But I thought if you can determine the identity of one of these symbolic entities, that by association, the other two ought to be fairly easy to figure out, right? So I remember, you know, and I'm reading this mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. I thought, this sounds so familiar. You know, I know I've seen it somewhere else in the Bible. So I start looking for it. And it's in Ezekiel chapter 16. But I think if you read that, it pretty much identifies, you know, and it's Ezekiel confronting Jerusalem about, you know, how Israel and Jerusalem has never lived up to their, you know, side of the chosenness or whatever, you know, and this land in the Middle East. People say that it was given to the Jews. You know, well, it was always conditional. You know, as long as you obeyed the law that I give you, and this and that and the other. And I think that, you know, the first temple was destroyed by Babylon in 586 BC. The second temple was established 70 AD. And I think that was foretold in Matthew 24 by Jesus, you know, that he's with his apostles. And of course, this is, you know, the week of his crucifixion, and they're showing him the buildings of you know, the temple, and Jesus said, you know, won't be one stone left here standing, you know. So at 38 years later in 70 AD, you know, the Romans come and knock down the second temple, right? But anyway, so it gets into some of the other symbolic references. It talks about a seven-headed beast, you know, the beast that was and then was not and then yet is, that survived a deadly head wound by a sword, you know. It just seems like that, if Jerusalem is, you know, Mystery Babylon the Great, that it's probably Israel, that was the beast that was prior to 70 AD, then was not 70 AD to 1940 AD, and yet is. But then the alarming thing is and there's another two-horned beast that comes out of the land, you know, and begins to exercise all the power of the first beast before him. Anyway, you know, I guess you try to make sense of the world that you live in.
I seem to have lost you. I assume I'm still on the air.
Okay.
But looks like the two-horned beast has intervened to silence Glenn Stanish. Kevin Barrett, this is Truth Jihad Radio. And we're talking with retired Air Force officer and commercial airline pilot Glenn Stanish.
Well, I was always civilian.
As he was getting into the two-horned beast of Revelations. Let me just make sure. Did he ask my producer if the guest dropped, which is what I assume happened? Because it looks like I'm still on the call. I wonder if
can you hear me,
he's
Kevin?
Muted or something. He's supposed to still be on the call.
Yeah, I'm still here, Kevin. Do you have me? Hello?
Hey, hello, Glenn.
Yeah, do you have me?
Yeah. I think I just dropped. I lost you when you were talking about the identity of the two-horned beast, I think.
Yeah.
I guess the beast intervened. Didn't want it to be outed.
It's interesting, but anyway, I'm not sure what all you got or. I blink out? It seemed like you couldn't hear me for a while. I could hear you.
Yeah, I guess it was probably on my end. We do occasionally have internet outages here in Morocco. Not very often, though.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. In any case, just to react to what you were saying, it does seem to me that there's a pretty good case to be made that Zionism is, or is at least related to, Antichrist, given that the people called Jews are the people who rejected Jesus and indeed scorn Jesus. The real traditional Jewish tradition is very hostile to Jesus. So you would think Antichrist might come out of that. And then we have that whole history of the false Messiah, Shabtai Zvi, the self-proclaimed sort of, you know, satanic false Messiah, this whole current of heretical satanical Judaism, and the heresy that emerged from Judaism that's become a kind of Satanism and does seem to be involved in the state of Israel. So Yeah, I mean, the short version of that would be Israel is Antichrist. Am I oversimplifying?
Yeah. No, I agree. It definitely is an Antichrist state. It seems like the Talmud, some of the things that are written in the Talmud about Jesus and Mary and Christians and Gentiles, you know, is just amazing.
And they spit on Christians and defend it. They say it's a custom.
Yeah. It's really, I don't know. Zionist Christians, you know, that seem to be, you know, that Israel can do no wrong, and that, you know, this repopulating the Holy Land or whatever was is part of, you know, is biblical. And from my understanding, and I've read, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the brother Nathaniel Kapner.
Yes, I've watched a couple of his videos.
Okay. I think he's pretty good. I like him. He's bold. He's not afraid of anyone that's going to call him an anti-Semite or a Holocaust denier or whatever, you know. And he was raised as a Jew, and it wasn't until he was in college that he got a hold of the New Testament, you know, but became Christian. But anyway, he explains that the return of the Jews to the Holy Land had already taken place in the Old Testament. There's nothing in the New Testament about this political, you know, physical nation state of Israel to be, you know, brought in as or recreated or whatever, you know, as the nation of Israel. I do think it makes me wonder. So the only New Testament entity that New Testament scripture that talks about you know, the gathering of Jews, again, it refers to this beast, you know, and that this tribulation. I think what's going to happen, there is a movement, and there's a great interest in Israel to build a third temple, you know, and if it ever gets constructed, I don't know how long it'll be standing, but I think it's going to happen again a third time, you know.
And if some would-be world ruler were enthroned in a rebuilt temple, I think we could safely assume that that would be the Antichrist.
The false prophet. Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, but it is just the way things are going these days. It just makes you wonder, you know, at what speed and what direction we're accelerating towards that period of time.
Yeah, it's true. It's kind of, I'm still stunned at the shamelessness of this genocide in Gaza. It's just
exactly
beyond belief.
Yeah. Right.
And I thought they could get away with that for, you know, for a couple of weeks. But I couldn't imagine it could go on for 6 months.
Yeah, I was looking at a news piece yesterday. There are groups of settlers that are looking forward to redeveloping Gaza, you know.
Yeah, they're selling real estate in synagogues here in the United States, apparently.
Golly.
Yeah, it's. I mean, who needs anti-Semitism when you've got these people? You know, I mean, the shamelessness of it is just amazing.
Right.
And I think there's an awakening happening, though, partly because of the extreme shamelessness of it all, that the younger generation is turning against Israel. 18 to 24 year old majority now in America is siding with the Palestinian resistance, which is pretty amazing. And there's also, it seems, more and more people who are willing to look into these kinds of issues like 9/11, JFK, and even the Holocaust, because in the past, people have been kind of scared to go there. And this, the shocking quality of this genocide, which makes you, you know, and then the way it's misreported in the mainstream, is waking up a lot of people to wonder, you know, wait a minute, okay, this, there's this genocide or Holocaust right now, but wait a minute, it's the people perpetrating it are the people that we've been told are the ultimate victims of genocides and Holocausts. And yet we understand there are these people who question that story out there. So people are starting to look into that too. And I wonder, it's too late for that.
There was a, what's his name? And I saw it on Veterans Today. I can't think of his name, but anyway, you know, I was talking to, he had like this staged, argument, with, an Orthodox Holocaust believer. And then he was, you know, someone who subscribed to, different theories about the Holocaust. But anyway, that one of the things he was saying is that, you know, that never again seems to refer to them only. That definitely doesn't seem to refer to the Palestinians.
Right. And then you have to wonder, to what extent is this whole fixation with this Holocaust and this whole kind of Jewish paranoia of this, you know, the notion that the Goyim or all the non-Jewish peoples are out to persecute Jews for no particular reason, and they all ultimately, you know, want to get rid of us and so on. A lot of Jews, to one extent or another, are brought up with that kind of paranoia. Not all, certainly. And then you wonder about, you know, how to what extent is all of this kind of some kind of psychological projection, and is a lot of it really about generating an excuse to behave badly, really. In other words, is the whole point of the Holocaust story to justify the kind of, you know, behavior, you know, shown in the Tarantino film Inglourious Basterds, where they're just sadistically getting revenge on the Germans, and now this, you know, sadistically acting out on the Palestinians? It's all excused by this whole mythology of, oh, we've always been persecuted. Well, what if you haven't? What if the problems that you've had with your neighbors, every single neighbor that you've ever had, maybe the problem was with you. And, you know, people, of course, are, you're never allowed to say it because it's just so obvious.
Yeah. It, it's like, a lot of families have someone in their family who, whatever is troubled or whatever. Maybe he addicted or an alcoholic, and, you know, causes a lot of trouble for the rest of the family, right? Well, it seems like the family of nations has one of those.
yeah, problem child. And yeah, the on the other hand, the, you know, there are some very positive aspects of Jewish culture as well, in terms of the focus on education, some extent critical thinking, outside of the box, because they're always outside of whatever culture they happen to be living in terms of the mainstream culture. But there's a good side of that too. And even though, you know, the overall, you know, the power structure of the tribe ends up being pretty evil, as we're seeing now, there are plenty of Jewish individuals who, for one reason or another, you know, react against the bad side of their tribal power and become leading critics of it. You know, we're seeing a lot of good work done by Max Blumenthal, and Ron Unz of the Unz Review is doing amazing work. Whole lot of these people come out of Jewish backgrounds and become, you know, leading truth tellers.
Yeah, that Brother Kapner.
Exactly. Henry McCoe is another one sort of like him, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, a few bad apples in leadership positions, you know, can lead a flock astray.
Yeah, and we have that, you know, all groups, I think, tend to have that problem. The people you want for your leaders are probably people who don't really want to be leaders. And the ones who want power or hungry for power might not be the ones who should be leaders in the first place. And that problem may be, you know, exaggerated in the Jewish community, but I think that's a universal human problem.
Yeah, you're right. I agree. I agree.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, and we should probably mention your book, Uncle Sam's Christian Patriots. Maybe could sum up what that's about.
Well, I'm wondering now. Sometimes it was my first attempt, you know. So going back, I was telling you I was trying to find more material kind of disprove some of the 9/11 conspiracy. Whoop.
Yeah, you're still there.
Okay. I guess I got another call coming in. But anyway, so I gathered all this material, and it's like, all right, what am I going to do with all this? And I thought, well, let me try to put a book together. And so like I said, it was my first attempt. Initial publisher, Tate Publishing, it was a Christian publishing outlet out of Mustang, Oklahoma. They eventually liquidated and went out of business. And at the time, I was still working and still flying. I thought, well, maybe when I retire or some other time, I can get back to maybe trying to put it back together. But I thought, during that time, I did have a couple of different opportunities to republish with some smaller publishing houses. And so anyway, I got a call from Reader's Magnet about a year ago and said that they were interested. And it's like, okay, let's go ahead and do it. And so we kind of threw together, it's officially a second edition, but it's not, there's no additional material. It's all just what was in the first book, you know.
Okay, and I put a link to it on the radio blog, which people can find by going to truthjihad.com and clicking on the radio show link. Find your way to the listing for today's show, March 22nd, and you'll find that link to Uncle Sam's Christian Patriots by Glenn Stanish. Well, thank you, Glenn. It's been a very interesting conversation. Appreciate your brave work. Keep it up.
Thank you, Kevin. I enjoyed it, and it was really nice talking with you.
Likewise. All right. Take care. God bless.
God bless.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
That's Glenn Stanish. Kevin Barrett here of kevinbarrett.substack.com, back in the next hour with journalist Rick Sterling to talk about Olympic doping and from Dallas to Gaza, how JFK's assassination was good for Zionist Israel. Stick around.
Natural law. Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crip Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crip Rick's iPhone, thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
Mountain High Time, 2 hours of an organization to the madness, discussing the ever-changing dynamics of being both physically and mentally prepared for a plethora of possible outcomes to our future and present. A look into the latest technologies, new scientific discoveries, and how they might be used in connection to the human domain and controlling it, ancient cultures and places. Be warned. This is an opinionated look through headlines. Guests that are not afraid to question the narrative. A little bit of crazy ramblings of a stoner conspiracy factist that pushes constitutional concepts. The place and the time are the same, another dimension we call Mountain High Time. Saturdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Mountain High Time. right here on revolution.radio, where information never sleeps and truth breaks the spell.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back. This is the live edition of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett. I've been doing this show since 2006 when I started out on RBN, Republic Broadcasting, and then quickly jumped over to Genesis. I think I had shows on both Republic and Genesis for a while. Then from there, it was We the People and et cetera, et cetera. Now I've been on American Freedom Radio, the ultimate in free speech networks, for many years. I can't even count them at this point without taking my shoes off. So anyway, it's been great. I appreciate the listeners' support, and it's good to have total unfettered free speech. Thank you, revolution.radio. Okay, let's get into the second hour. First hour, we talked with Glenn Stanish about a whole lot of issues, including the good news that Christopher Bolin is doing fine. Now we're going to move on to talk about Olympic doping for a while, and we'll also touch on From Dallas to Gaza, how JFK's assassination was good for Zionist Israel. That's the penultimate article from Rick Sterling, a West Coast journalist whose latest article is indeed about the Olympic doping case. He suggests that it's likely that the U.S. services created the situation in which the great figure skater Kamila Valieva was supposedly found guilty of some kind of doping. It turned out it was a very, very weak case, but for some reason it was used in an attempt to smear Russia in preparation for the war in Ukraine. So let's get into it. Hey, welcome, Rick Sterling. How are you?
Yeah, fine, Kevin. Good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. Appreciate your excellent work on a bunch of controversial topics, kind of stuff that gets you deplatformed and shadow banned in today's internet environment. It's speaking of which, have you noticed how bad it's gotten over the past 6 or 8 years in terms of, you know, we used to have a pretty free internet and we just don't anymore, do we?
Absolutely. Now the news is out today that Candace Owen has been fired from the Daily Wire because she disagreed with some people there about the about Israel.
She doesn't like genocide.
Exactly. Yeah, she's not all gung-ho for genocide. Correct.
Yeah, I guess that's a firing offense if you're working for Ben Shapiro. Glad I'm not working for Ben Shapiro. I'm sure you are, too. So these are the kinds of topics that are very likely to get you shadow banned, of course. Questioning this Kamila Valieva case, it might sound like, oh, we're just talking about sports and politics, but when it's part of this multifaceted intelligence operation to try to take down Russia, by hook or by crook, and including by launching a war through Ukraine, yeah. then you know, the folks behind that are also, they have branches and tentacles in the internet censorship industry as well.
Right. Yeah. Well, this began really the accusations against Russia for quote unquote state sponsored doping. That case began after the coup in Kiev and after the people of Crimea voted overwhelmingly to reunify with Russia. Then subsequent to that, which was a turning point in the relations or a turning point in the hostility of the West against Russia, charges of state-sponsored doping emerged against Russia. There's kind of a long history, and I've written many articles about that with Grigory Ronchenkov and other examples. The interesting thing is that all of the people who have are the supposed eyewitnesses or the people who are whistleblowers were themselves the primary people involved with this. Grigory Rodchenkov, who ran the Moscow laboratory, which was examining test samples, he was being paid. He was charging athletes to make their samples clean. So he was not working for the state. He was working for himself. He came over to the U.S. and instead of being an example of somebody who was involved with doping, he became a supposed whistleblower because he made the accusations against the Russian government in his higher ups. But actually, he was at the core of it. And then the Stepanovs, Yulia Stepanov and her husband, they were also involved with doping. And her husband, who was working for the Russian anti-doping agency, he was getting the doping pharmaceuticals for his wife. She was a struggling, you know, athlete, middle distance runner, and her career wasn't going so well. So she, as you know, athletes are tempted to do around the world. It's not just Russia or the United States or Canada or wherever. She was guilty of doping, but she came over to the U.S. and effectively defected, and then she became suddenly a whistleblower who was clean as the driven snow. New York Times and PBS have been, you know, promoting this story, and then it's kind of has gone on from there. I can give a kind of a detailed look at it, but I think we want to get to the case of the most immediate case of the Russian figure skater, Kamila Valieva.
Yeah, that's the one that your article focuses on, and it's kind of astounding. I mean, just the basic facts of this are quite astonishing. That, you know, she's the best figure skater in the world, and she ends up being smeared for supposedly doping with something that she could never, you know, she never would have used. It's nothing performance enhancing about the stuff that they claimed that she was using.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So if we go back to the fall of 2021, leading up to the Beijing Winter Olympics in February 2022, there were, you know, the preeminent figure skating championships and events being held around the world. In late October, it was held in Canada. And in her debut performance as a senior, as an adult, or considered an adult at the top level of skating, she just blew away the competition. She set all sorts of records, and the announcers were astounded at her artistry and her skill and flexibility. And then she went on, after that event in Canada, she went on to win the European Figure Skating Championship, the Russian Figure Skating Championship. All along the way, of course, premier world-class athletes are you know, required to give urine samples, and then those are tested for prohibited drugs. Well, she had 18 tests over a couple of years. They were all clean. In other words, it was negative for any prohibited substance. Well, at the end of December, just 6 weeks before the Beijing Olympics was to start, she did a urine sample, and then it was not the results of that test didn't emerge until the Olympics was already underway. So she had clean tests, confirmed clean tests in all of the other tournaments, but the sample that she gave it at the end of December from the Russian National Championship was being evaluated, being analyzed by a Swedish laboratory, and for very, very unclear reasons that those test results, which are supposed to be given, ordinarily they're produced within 10 days. In that case there, they were not given for 45 days. And it emerged in the middle or at the beginning of the Beijing Olympics. And when the results came out that the top Russian figure skater, Kamila Valieva, had tested positive, it totally upended not only Kamila Valieva, it really threw a wrench in the Olympics. And people who were following the Olympics at that time would know very well how it kind of took over the Olympics in a way, at least in the Western media coverage, and disrupted the Olympics. And so instead of watching all the performances of all the athletes, there was this tremendous controversy and this sensational rumor and news about a Russian figure skater being doping. So it was the familiar story of the Russians are doping again. So my article looks into the facts of the case. And just to give listeners a snapshot, so she was allowed to compete in the competition because she was only 15 years old and considered a minor, and because the circumstances were so bizarre. It's completely unheard of for test results to come in that late. And there were a lot of strange circumstances, and then it took actually 2 years up until February of a month ago for the Court of Arbitration for Sport to make a determination on the arguments. The Russians, of course, saying that she has no idea how she tested positive for this trace amount of a medication called trimetazidine, which is a heart treatment that people take who have had heart attacks. One of the side effects of trimetazidine is it makes you dizzy. So you can't imagine a medication that would be less helpful to a figure skater. In any case, the determination came out from the Court of Arbitration for Sport she was found that she had not proven that she was innocent, therefore she's guilty, and they slammed her with 4-year ban and the forfeiture of all of her earnings, all of her medals and prizes subsequent to that December sample that she made at the Russian National Championships.
Right, and this TMZ, this heart supplement that she was busted for, I'm kind of confused about why that's disqualifying, because as you say, it's not really a performance enhancing drug. It's a drug for people with heart attacks. So the way this works apparently is that if you're participating in the Olympics you have to test. Basically, you have a list of approved medications that you're taking. Any supplement or medication you're taking, you have on a list. And so if you take anything whatsoever that's not on that list, even if it's not remotely performance enhancing, you can be disqualified?
Correct. There's a list of prohibited medications that the World Anti-Doping Agency has produced. And if a medication is not on that list, it means it's permitted. And if it is on that list, it means that if you're found with any of that in your system. Now, most medications or most drugs that are on that list, there's a minimum level there. In other words, it has to pass some threshold, because some experts say that it's very dangerous to have no minimum level, because a lot of medications are in the environment now. Whether it's the food environment, the air environment, the water you drink, there's chemicals all around us all the time. This expert was saying that it's very dangerous not to have any minimal level. Most of the drugs that are on that list, there's some threshold that the detection of has to, you have to cross that threshold for it to be considered to be, truly in your system. In the case of trimethoxazine, there is no minimum level, just the smallest amount. In her case, it was 2.1 billionth grams per milliliter. So an infinitesimal amount of this chemical was in her system, and yet they slammed her with a anti-drug rule violation because of that.
Now, is there any history of TMZ being used to enhance athletic performance?
TMZ or trimethoxazine was not banned until 2014. Then it was put on the list, and some people say it was put on the list because it has been used by some athletes, some premier athletes in Asia and Russia. For example, the great Chinese swimmer Sun Yang, who's the world record holder in middle and distance swimming, his doctor prescribed trimethoxazine to him, and he took it, and it was not on the banned list. And the reason he took it is because during very long training sessions, he occasionally had heart palpitations. So that's an example where it was being used by an athlete. And where it's infrequently used by athletes in endurance sports where they're, going, they're training very hard and it's to prevent a heart attack, essentially, or to dampen heart palpitations in the case of Sun Yang. In any case,
totally irrelevant for figure skating.
Exactly. You can watch Kamila Valieva skating in many performances, and I recommend to listeners to look at her figure skate. It's just astounding, her artistry and her talent. But she's barely breathing, and she's breathing hard at the end of her performance. But it's not as though she's gasping for breath or anything like that.
No, she's not like courting heart attacks or anything. That's for sure.
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
That's crazy. So I mean, this is so transparently political and so obviously unjust. It really kind of makes you wonder about the way it was reported in the West.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, that's an interesting aspect, because as soon as it came out, or as soon as the rumors began that a Russian figure skater had tested positive and was They're very quick to say somebody's a drug cheat. They're very and very quick to claim, well, we need to protect clean sport, and that person's automatically guilty. And that is the case. If a banned drug is found in a person's test, you're guilty unless you can prove your innocence. So it's kind of the reverse of what's the standard presumption of innocence. You're presumed to be guilty. But nobody, none of the commentators and none of the prominent Western athletes were at all suspicious or were at all skeptical. What would be the value of trimetazidine for a figure skater? It doesn't make any sense, especially one who is so talented and so obviously, you know, superb and the best figure skater in the world. It was clear to all. She was blowing away the competition. So what would be her motivation? Of course, there have been many cases where premier athletes did dope. You know, Ben Johnson, or there's lots of examples. But typically, those are people who are recovering from injury or athletes who have, you know, gone down to the second or third tier and they're trying to get back to regain their performance or whatever. So, you know, you can think that there's some motive, but there's, you know, you cannot think of any motive for Camila Valieva to take a medication, with her level of excellence in figure skating.
Especially medication that has no benefits whatsoever for performance and has the side effect of causing dizziness.
Exactly. And especially, I mean, just to add to how preposterous the it is, I mean, she knows she's going to be tested in all the competitions. So, you know, imagine you're the best figure skater in the world, and that's not me saying it or her saying it. It's all of the commentators saying it, and it's proven by the results. She has every motive to stay 100 miles away from anything that could be contributed or anything that could be considered prohibited or banned. So it's all illogical, but that kind of logic is absent from the people. She was quickly condemned at the Olympics when the decision was made to allow her to continue competing at the Beijing Olympics. Many Western athletes condemned the decision, said she should be sent home immediately, should not be allowed to compete. So you can just imagine the amount of pressure that was on the young woman. She's in this hostile environment with this accusation that's coming from a test that she submitted 6 weeks earlier. The whole situation was bizarre. The other interesting element of this is that it totally disrupted the Beijing Olympics, which had a spectacular beginning, opening ceremony, and China was very proud that they were hosting for the first time ever the Winter Olympics. This was very much against the Western elites. In fact, Nancy Pelosi had campaigned for a diplomatic boycott of the Olympics. U.S. politicians had said the Olympics should be postponed or moved, supposedly because of the quote-unquote genocide in the Xinjiang amongst the Uyghurs in China.
Yeah, we know how much the American politicians hate genocide, don't we?
Exactly. Yeah, they're at the drop of a hat, they're accusing China of genocide, but they can't find a way to make that observation on Gaza.
Yeah, so this was a real PR coup for the American empire, disrupting the Beijing Olympics, smearing Russia's brightest star. It kind of, yeah. If I were a paranoid conspiracy theorist, I would think that the Americans found a way to manufacture this. In fact, I don't think you have to be very paranoid to think that.
No, you don't imagine the CIA would do something that dirty, do you?
Well, no, they don't. They don't lie and cheat, do they? Well, Pompeo did, but
right, right. Well, in my article, I include some quotes from a report that was produced by the Department of Defense, produced by the RAND Corporation, which has a long history of being the military's think tank, and they have an article. A report that is called Overextending and Unbalancing Russia. And in this report, they say that the U.S. objective is to undermine Russia's stature and undermining Russia's image internationally. And they refer to sports there. And, of course, this was the perfect case. At the Olympics, of course, at the Winter Olympics, figure skating is one of the most watched sports because it's pretty amazing. They're very short performances. It's just very beautiful to see, even if you're not a skater or not a person who watches figure skating normally. It's pretty astounding to watch, just like the gymnastics at the Summer Olympics.
Right, but, exactly. Even if you don't follow the Olympics closely, that's probably something that you might actually want to watch a little bit of.
Exactly, exactly. And I do recommend listeners, take a look at Kamila Valieva. Lots of her performances are on YouTube. But in any case, they hit the jackpot with tearing her down, and instead of the Russian sweeping the individual skating competition and winning the team skating competition with the stature that would have, with the respect and the admiration of the world for the achievements of these young women, instead of that, you had, here's the Russians doping again. And it all fed the Russophobia, and it fed all of the accusations, and it had the additional bonus of disrupting the Beijing Olympics, which Nancy Pelosi and the U.S. was engaged in a diplomatic boycott of anyway.
And this all happened at such a propitious time for the disruptors, because it was right before Russia moved into the Donbass on February 24th. So this was just a couple of weeks before that. So it greased the skids for this war in terms of the whole American strategy was to paint the Russians as evil aggressors who would be totally boycotted and shunned by the whole civilized world. And we'd ultimately get, a boycott of Russia, and their economy would collapse, and Putin would fall, and there would be regime change, and there'd be a new pliant puppet like Yeltsin in charge to hand over all of Russia's raw materials to the West. So that strategy of taking down Russia through Ukraine required having a PR smear campaign against Russia just as that war was beginning. And you couldn't have asked for a better opportunity for that than this this fiasco at the Olympics.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So the news broke on February 7. And so it was just of 2022, just a couple of weeks before Russia made the decision. And during that whole winter, as Kamila Valieva was competing in the figure skating championships and winning them all, that was the time where the U.S. was turning up the screws exacerbating the tension. In Ukraine, started bombing the Donbass region more heavily and rejecting the proposed treaty that Russia sent to the U.S. and to NATO at the end of December. So it was a very consequential time. It was a time of extreme tension and pressure between the U.S. and Russia. And I believe that the U.S. wanted Russia to cross the line, to intervene, and to invade Ukraine, because I believe they thought, and they had the sanctions all prepared, very, as is obvious, It wasn't. It was just days after Russia went into the Donbass region that the U.S. unveiled all these, and the West unveiled all these sanctions on Russia. So they had obviously prepared that. So the sports is just one element of the propaganda war, the tension, and it's really a sad consequence. The whole the disaster in Ukraine is so unnecessary. The loss of life, mostly Ukrainians, but Russians as well. You know, some people are saying hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian troops have been killed. And it's so unnecessary. They had a very, if they had just followed the Minsk Accords, you know, it wouldn't have happened. But instead, the West wanted to use Ukraine as a battering ram, and just like they wanted to, they use sports to make accusations against Russia. You know, they wanted to use Ukraine to try to weaken and divide Russia, and it's obviously backfired.
Right. I think it was also a U.S. imperial attempt to keep Europe subjugated. Remember, as you mentioned in the article, as this was happening in February 2022, Biden threatened the Nord Stream pipeline, saying mm-hmm. that if Russia intervenes in Ukraine, there will no longer be a Nord Stream pipeline. We will bring an end to it, which of course he did. And Seymour Hersh has exposed how he did. And the effect of that was to keep Europe down, and in particular to keep Germany's industry down, so that European productivity has to move to the United States, and Europe has to buy expensive energy from the United States rather than cheap energy from Russia. So the overall effect of it was to prop up the U.S., prop up the dollar, and keep Europe subjugated to the U.S. And really, Europe has been more or less occupied by the U.S. ever since World War II, and still is. And this was a way of maintaining that occupation. So you could argue that this war, it's not just a U.S. war on Russia through Ukraine, it's also a U.S. war on Europe through Ukraine.
I think you're right. I agree with that. And talking about occupied, there's an example of the propaganda is a Netflix series titled Occupied, where supposedly Russia has occupied Norway. And it talks about the Norwegians being subjugated to Russia, and the whole thing, you know, all of these narratives of Russia is going to be conquering all of these other countries in West Europe if we don't.
Russia needs land. The one thing they really need is more land.
Exactly, and it's also preposterous. And so because we know that Russia has made a red line for, you know, over two decades that it will not permit Ukraine to become a member of NATO, a military a part of the West. And they've said that over and over and over. And it was only when the West has thrown it in their faces by not only coordinating the coup in Kiev, but then doing all the aggression and the installation of the Azov Battalion in the east, and then the preparations for attacks on the Donbass, and the violations of the Minsk Accord, and the ignoring of the agreement of the Minsk Accord. It's only when they've been forced to that they've gone into Ukraine, and yet the people in the West are talking about this nonsense that we need to stop them now, otherwise they'll be running over West Europe, including Norway. It's all preposterous.
Yeah, Norway is pretty far away. I mean, Finland is a little closer. There was precedent for that, I guess, in World War II. Yeah. But you know, next it'll be the Russians are planning a sea invasion of Iceland or something like that. And I'm sure Netflix could have fun with that. But the propaganda, though, even though it's often ludicrous, seems to work because most people aren't paying close attention. like I wasn't really paying close attention to those Olympics, and I sort of vaguely heard this stuff about this doping scandal and kind of moved on. But all I really remembered hearing was the usual suspects are charging the Russians with doping. Oh, those dirty Russians, they're always doping. And that's all I really heard. And I being suspicious now, having looked into so many of these issues, I obviously don't take that at face value. But there are a lot of people that do. And so, just as people hear that Hamas has beheaded 40 babies, the first thing they hear about this October 7th war is that. And then it gets debunked, but the people who aren't paying close attention, they just heard about it and they didn't follow the debunking. And so it just goes into the primitive reptilian brain as sort of this emotional predisposition to think that Hamas is a bunch of monsters. Just like in this case, it's Valieva's case, it goes into the reptile brain and people get this impression that Russia is a bunch of cheating, doping criminals.
And
propaganda seems to usually work that way, that it doesn't have to be very well supported by facts. It can be pretty preposterous as long as it gets them the right headline. And even if it's going to be debunked in a week or even a day, it doesn't really matter. It still has its effect.
I think you're correct. I agree with you.
Yeah. And well, of all the people who are masters of really grotesquely mendacious propaganda, let's say the Zionists probably win the prize. And so let's talk about your other article, From Dallas to Gaza, How JFK's Assassination Was Good for Zionist Israel. You're not the only person who's been saying things like this. Ray McGovern, for example, just recently in an interview with, I think, Judge Napolitano, made a kind of similar, much shorter remark that suggested that he was aware of the case that was first developed by Michael Collins Piper, that Israel played the lead role in the Kennedy assassinations. And your article doesn't really get into the pinning of the responsibility of the assassinations. It simply points out who benefits, and that most people, like I was a Kennedy assassination buff from the mid-1970s through the early 1990s. And I don't remember running into even anybody noticing that Israel had benefited so greatly from the assassination.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, it's been extremely well hidden. And I was very surprised myself to discover all these things. And I did it because I helped to organize an event in November of last year, which was the 60th anniversary of the JFK assassination. So in the course of and I'd written previous articles about JFK and foreign policy. There's the book JFK and the Unspeakable, which is very good and which has a lot of information about JFK's moves toward peace and negotiation and compromise with the Soviet Union. He really had a very different notion of foreign policy. The Vietnam War would very likely not have happened if he had continued as president, in other areas, the assassination or the coup in Indonesia in 1965 would not have happened. In fact, he had accepted an invitation from Sukarno to visit Indonesia. So he was friendly to Sukarno, President Sukarno of Indonesia, who was a leader of the non-aligned movement. So he had a completely different foreign policy, and I was very much aware of that. But as I started looking into it, and I've always been, interested and concerned with the situation in Palestine and Israel. I started seeing things that were really interesting to me and specific cases. And I guess it was the literature that's come out in the last few years about Dimona, the nuclear facility in Israel, and the development of the nuclear the atomic bomb at Dimona, and the war of words through secret letters between the Israeli Prime Minister Ben-Gurion and Kennedy. And then now some of this documentation has only been released in recent years. And when I looked at the actual letters, it was astounding, because in diplomatic language, JFK was laying down the law. He was giving the ultimatum to Ben-Gurion that the U.S. needed to inspect this nuclear facility that was under construction at the time. And then I started looking into other elements, and I discovered, to my surprise, at that time in 1963, the U.S. was not giving any military aid to Israel. All it gave was food and humanitarian supplies. And the U.S. was supporting the Palestinian right of return, UN Resolution 194. And of course, I knew from the past that Kennedy had been very friendly with Gamal Abdel Nasser, the nationalist president of Egypt, and that Kennedy had supported Algerian independence against France. So it became clear that that Kennedy really was on a different wavelength and was conducting a very different policy than not only, you know, is happening now, but happened immediately after his death. Another interesting element is that the parent organization that gave birth to AIPAC was the Zionists of America, and the Kennedy administration was adamant that they needed to register as agents under the FARA Act as foreign agents. And, you know, you can imagine how big a change that would be if AIPAC was not allowed to do all the sorts of things that they're able to do and not be recognized as agents of a foreign country and not required to fulfill all the obligations that organizations so designated have to comply with. So there were all these, well, I identified the four different areas where Kennedy's policy was really different, and how the evolution of Israel could have been really different than it has been. It, you know, it was really the cementing, his death was the cementing, his, not just his death, but LBJ, who was a completely subservient to Israel and dependent on Israel, how Kennedy's death and LBJ's assumption of the presidency really cemented hardcore Zionism and prevented the possibility of some kind of peaceful resolution whereby the Jewish people in Israel and the Palestinian people could find some kind of a workable compromise. And that's what JFK was working towards, and that's what ended. And it was also news to me and very interesting that there was a lot of opposition to Zionism and to a militant supremacist state of Israel, both within Israel and within the American Jewish community. In fact, my article was just recently reprinted by the American Council for Judaism, which at the time in the 1940s and 50s and even into the 60s was a very prominent Jewish organization. It was anti-Zionist. And so there were a lot of bad things happened with the JFK assassination.
That's to putting it mildly. You quote JFK as telling the Zionists, quote, I cannot believe that Israel has any real desire to remain indefinitely a garrison state surrounded by fear and hate. Well, that's pretty much could have been said last week, right? I mean, it's
exactly
the Israelis are now. I mean, this new Nakba might be even worse than the first one. Mm-hmm. And the first one has earned them the absolute enmity of a billion people in their region. Mm-hmm. And this one You know, it's going to be off the charts. I mean, do they really think that this is a good way to get on in that region and in the world?
Yeah, I think that's a great quote from JFK, and I included it because, you know, that quote is from a speech. He was campaigning to be president in 1960, and he was speaking before the Zionists of America. And he said various complimentary things about Israel, but Kennedy spoke clearly. He spoke with without subterfuge. It wasn't just a PR exercise or a campaign promotion. And you know, as you say, that sentence could be delivered. You know, last week, and it's definitely the case that they have followed the path of Kennedy said he hoped they wouldn't be, or he couldn't imagine that they would want to be a garrison state surrounded by fear and hate. But that's obviously what
the failure of imagination.
Yeah, well, it's I guess it's what they wanted in a way, but they claim they want security. The Zionists always claim they want security, and that's why they have to eliminate Hamas. Well, they're doing it by killing tens of thousands of people. No, they're just engendering more hate.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems kind of preposterous that they really think that implanting the settler colony in this part of the world and making the whole region just absolutely loathe them is somehow going to work out well for them. It's just mind-boggling. I don't know where there are various analyses of where that mentality comes from. I know you mentioned that you've read Laurent Guyonneau's book JFK 9/11, and Laurent Guyonneau also wrote From Yahweh to Zion, which I translated and published, which is an analysis of Jewish identity politics and the influence of Jewish religion on it over the centuries. And he speculates that there is actually a religious factor involved. He thinks that the Torah or Old Testament is kind of at the heart of it. But we are seeing now a kind of a rethinking by a lot of people looking at the genocide of Gaza and the way it's being misreported in the media, and noticing that there's something very, very wrong here. But do you have any thoughts about what's led to this Zionist mentality that's so obviously genocidal and also self-destructive?
Yes. I think it was the Kennedy assassination was pivotal because, you know, before his assassination, there were strong voices. In fact, they were prominent Jewish voices in America, including Albert Einstein, who were vehemently against. They were calling the super Zionists terrorists and fascists. And there was the philosopher Martin Buber. There were a lot of prominent voices both within Israel and within the U.S. who wanted to find some kind of accommodation. And it's interesting about JFK. He went there in 1939. He went and he spent some time in Israel, and then he wrote a very lengthy letter to his father about his observations. And one of his observations is still true today. He said it's very much divided between a hardcore fundamentalist community that is unwilling to make any compromise, and then a more liberal community that's really at odds with the hardcore religious fanatics.
But is that still true, Rick? Because the polls today show that, you know, from 2008 on, and you know, Operation Cast Lead and each of these mowings of the lawn in Gaza are supported by a near unanimous chunk of Jewish Israeli public opinion, not the Arab Israeli public opinion, of course. Arabs are 20% of the population of Israel, but among the Jews of Israel, it's 90% plus support these massacres and genocides. So what's changed?
I think I spent the summer of 2007 living with a Palestinian family in Palestine, and then traveling around Palestine and Israel. And I remember going to a rally in Rabin Square in Tel Aviv, and it was really heartening to see thousands of young Israeli families marching against the occupation, saying that you can't be democratic and Jewish at the same time. That was a contradiction of terms to say you're a democracy but have preferential treatment for one ethnic group. So it was hard. That was very heartening. It was a minority then, and I think you're exactly right that it's an even smaller minority now, and they become even and the. The lockhold of Zionist ideology of ethnic supremacy has really gained ground. But the pivotal point about the JFK, what happened after his death was that the Zionists of America and AIPAC were not required to register as agents of a foreign government. The U.S. Reneged on UN Resolution 194, respecting rights for Palestinian refugees, and looked the other way as Israel proceeded to develop the nuclear bomb. And then in 1967, of course, you had the Six-Day War, which was pivotal, both within Israel and within the American Jewish community, because everybody loves a winner, and here they were winning in 6 days, and everything seemed to be rosy, and that was a huge turning point. And even at that point, you could tell the sense of impunity is pretty astounding, and it was because LBJ was in office that they attacked Israel. Israeli forces attacked the USS Liberty off the coast of Egypt during the Six-Day War, killed 34 U.S. sailors, injured another 194, and tried to sink the ship with the intention of blaming it on Egypt and then consolidating support of Israel, the support of the U.S. with Israel against Egypt and the Soviet Union. That's what I think it was the objective. But in any case, that happened, and LBJ looked the other way. He said, "I can't allow our ally to be embarrassed when a U.S. ship has been directly attacked." But since then, it's gone on. But up to the current time, I think October 7 is reversing what happened in 1967, in June 67, because the prison break that Hamas and other militant groups waged on October 7, successfully attacking military checkpoints and showing the weakness of the Israeli military, and then the subsequent inability of the Israeli military to crush Hamas, and the ongoing genocide has just reversed it. The whole world is reacting with horror, and I think the false image of a supremacist and unbeatable Israel has been effectively ended.
Yeah, I agree. Well, so where will it go? Do you think that since the U.S. empire seems to be losing in Ukraine and will very likely lose to China, which is still growing a lot faster than the U.S. and the West are, and then with this situation in Gaza where the whole global South, especially the nearly 2 billion strong Muslim world, and certainly this region, is turning strongly against the U.S. and ready for a post-American empire world. So at some point, will Israel either have to change or go down due to the U.S. empire no longer being able to prop it up?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the $64,000 question. What'll they do in failure, whether it's Israel or it's the United States? In some ways, they're kind of joined at the hip, unfortunately. It speaks very poorly of American democracy that you can have 75% of the U.S. population wanting a ceasefire in Gaza, and yet the U.S. administration has consistently denied that. They vetoed it in the UN, and what's happened in the last 24 hours at the UN, it was kind of a smokescreen. It was a pretend ceasefire resolution from the U.S., which was vetoed by China and Russia because they didn't want to go along with a smokescreen pretend ceasefire resolution that wasn't anything of the sort. So it's bad for the U.S. It's bad for Israel. And how to find a way out of it? How to find a way out of the U.S. spending $1 trillion a year on the empire and maintaining an empire as our own infrastructure falls apart, as a society breaks up, and Israel through all of its contradictions. I guess the danger is that some crazies will get power and that Israel will use a nuclear weapon, which they have, or the U.S. will keep provoking the U.S. and their puppets in West Europe will keep provoking the situation there instead of realizing that it's not that bad if Ukraine is neutral. What's so bad about that? And if the people in the eastern Ukraine want to be part of Russia instead of Ukraine, that should be their right. The people in Crimea, and I've been to Crimea twice, I mean, it's not close. It's like 90% of the population wants to be part of Russia. So what's so bad about Israel or what's so bad about Ukraine being neutral, and what's so bad about having ending apartheid in Israel and having one person, one vote? The Jewish people in Israel will do fine. They've got the education and all the advantages that they've had. What's wrong with having an equal state and ending apartheid and ending the occupation? It costs them a tremendous amount financially to maintain the apartheid state, to maintain the occupation. All of that could be done away with, and they would have vastly more security if they didn't have their foot on the neck of the Palestinian population, which is about the same amount as the Jewish population.
Former radio guest, the late lamented Alan Hart, used to say that Israel Palestine together could really be a powerhouse and a light unto the nations. It's a tragedy that the Zionists are so pig-headed. Well, we've hit the end of the show. I hear the bumper music. So thank you so much, Rick Sterling. It's been great. I appreciate those two excellent articles, and look forward to bringing you back on to talk about future ones.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That's Rick Sterling. I'm Kevin Barrett of Truth Jihad Radio, kevinbarrett.substack.com. See you back here on the live show on Revolution Radio next week, same time, same channel. Inshallah.
Listening to Revolution Radio.
What is going on here? I demand an explanation.
We work for a highly funded yet unofficial government agency.
An intelligence organization that fears intelligence, historically, not awesome.
The United States is a democratic nation. Here the people rule. We build no walls to keep them in, nor organize any system of police to keep them mute.
Freedom isn't free at all, but it comes with the highest of costs.
We have you, the listeners, and the hosts at
Revolution Radio. Radio. Radio.
For allowing us to bring you a platform of free speech.
1600 hours Eastern Studio A.